Welcome to Capon Ray Hall, nestled in the beautiful landscapes between England's national parks. As a Bible school, we offer short-term courses aimed at fostering your spiritual growth and living in a community. Our historic manor house has something for everyone. You can enjoy indoor and outdoor adventures, connect with students from around the world, and learn how to deepen your relationship with Jesus Christ. Search Capon Ray England for more information.
Well, hello and welcome to this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. It's the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio and all over the world via our podcast and our YouTube channel as well. You can find out more at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And we've got some really exciting plans in the pipeline to really expand the work of Unbelievable across the whole area of theology and apologetics this autumn and into next year. So hold on to your hats and look out for more for that later on in the year. And of course, we launched last week our Confident Christianity course as part of that ramping up of our activities. It's an online apologetics course. Wow, nearly 500 enrollments in this past week. Thank you so much for all the positive feedback we've received to it as well. We were offering a 50% discount for the first 5 days of October. We're actually going to extend a 30% discount to the end of the month. So this is still a great time to get hold of that course. It covers kind of all the main bases of apologetics, really: Christianity and atheism, philosophical evidence for God, science and faith, suffering, evidence for the life, death and resurrection of Jesus, with all those world-renowned thinkers: William Lane Craig, Amy Orr Ewing, John Lennox, Gary Habermas. I'm on it too, all from talks given at Unbelievable, the conference, alongside all the learning activities and questions that are part of the course. So again, that 30% discount that's still available, you can go to premier.org.uk/get-confident and enrol for our online apologetics course, Confident Christianity. Time to get into today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today we're looking at abortion law and the Texas Heartbeat Bill. There was widespread coverage recently of the so-called Texas Heartbeat Bill prohibiting abortion after 6 weeks gestation. Pro-life groups welcomed the change. Critics have said it's unfair and dangerous for women. And to discuss the religious, ethical and legal questions around abortion law in the USA, I'm joined by Stephanie Gray Connors and Bromley McClenahan. Stephanie is the founder of the pro-life charity Love Unleashes Life and the author of Love Unleashes Life, Abortion and the Art of Communicating Truth. She's a regular speaker in both Christian and secular settings on the subject of abortion. Reverend Bromley McClenahan is a church minister in the USA and the author of Good Christian Sex, Why Chastity is Not the Only Option. And when Alabama proposed restricting abortion, she wrote an article for the Washington Post titled, I'm a pro-choice minister and I'm far from the only one. We should speak up more. So those are the two positions, broadly speaking, of the guests, but obviously they'll be nuancing where they stand on these particular issues as we get into the programme today. So Stephanie and Bromley, welcome along to the show. We'll start with you, Stephanie. Tell us a bit about you, your work. I know that I think you've been speaking from a pro-life perspective from pretty early on, from the age of 18, I believe.
That's correct. So for more than two decades now, I've been traveling and educating people on who the preborn child is and the destructive nature of abortion to the youngest of our kind. And as you mentioned, I'm an author, authoring books not only on the beginning of life, but also the end of life. And I really try to raise awareness about what we mean when we speak about abortion and put definition to a word that has largely lost a lot of meaning.
And by and large, when it comes to the kinds of abortion law that we've been seeing, there's been this recent change in Texas. Where do you think the overall balance is going when it comes to these issues in the US? Would you say things are shifting in a more conservative or more liberal direction on abortion?
That's a great question. I would say it's actually doing both, depending on where in the United States you are. So there are some states where we see efforts made to increase access to abortion, to make sure people can get abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy. And then you have other more conservative states that are doing just the opposite, as we're seeing in Texas, where you have laws now that are saying when there's a detectable heartbeat that abortion is no longer acceptable or accessible, and therefore should not be allowed. So it's really dependent on where in the United States someone is.
When it comes to the particular reason you decided to get into this, I mean, you are a Christian, I think you're a Catholic, and was it that the kind of the impetus? And to what extent do you use, if you like, religiously motivated reasoning in the actual discussions and debates that you take part in?
You know, certainly my Catholic Christian background has provided a foundation for how I view human life. And at the same time, I would say I believe there are good non-sectarian reasons coming from a human rights perspective that someone could embrace to draw them to the conclusion that abortion should be rejected. So my religious worldview influences my perspective, but I have encountered people and often educate from a non-religious perspective, and those people in that argumentation can draw on a human rights argument that embraces equality for all humans, particularly the youngest of our kind.
And you've been willing to stand on many stages alongside many people to discuss and debate these ideas. What have been some of the more memorable, you know, platforms that you've shared with people to discuss these ideas?
So one of the key things I've done for the last two decades is formally debated people in favor of abortion, kind of like what we're doing now, but perhaps most significantly, I've debated abortion doctors themselves, not only physicians who do abortions only in the first trimester, but even a physician from Canada, where I'm originally from, who does abortions up to 23 weeks and 6 days. And given that the preborn child is considered viable, technically people will say 24 weeks, but babies have survived at 23, 22, even 21 weeks. We're talking then about debating someone who performs abortions after the time at which a baby could survive outside the womb. So that kind of stands out as being particularly significant because a lot of people are uncomfortable with later term abortion, and yet this particular physician was someone who wholeheartedly embraced it.
I'm looking forward to engaging you alongside Bromley on these issues. I know that you've also done a talk at Google. How did that go down there? Because I think many people assume, you know, a place like Google and the employees there, they're going to be very much on the liberal progressive end of the spectrum. What happened when you defended a pro-life position at Google?
Yes, you know, I have to give Google credit because in this time of a cancel culture, I appreciate the fact that the pro-life perspective was welcomed there through my presentation. And I would say that people were very respectful. I wasn't exactly sure what to expect, but when I made my presentation, people had a lot of good questions, but there wasn't the type of hostility or animosity that I have sometimes experienced on college campuses where people have, you know, made threats or been angry or, you know, where there was the requirement of security to protect myself as I spoke. And that certainly wasn't the case at Google. People were very respectful, and there has since been, you know, a couple hundred thousand views of the message.
It's an interesting platform to be able to speak on, and very relevant to my other guest, Bromley McLennan, because one of the things I discovered shortly before coming to do this show was that you've also done a talk at Google, Bromley, perhaps the first time I've had two guests who have both had that honour. Tell us a bit about yourself, though, Bromley. You're a church minister in the USA. I know this isn't the issue, you know, that you write and speak about generally, you know, and so I thank you for coming on the show to kind of give your perspective. But in fact, the issue you were talking at Google about was the subject of your last book, related, obviously, Good Christian Sex. Tell us about that and the kind of talk you were delivering at the time.
I gave a little bit of the genesis of the project itself when I was at Google. And I do think that that's sort of a useful approach in introducing folks to the topic. Certainly, I was working in a congregation when the book came out, and I was in one meeting where a committee member, a layperson in the church, was like, "And why exactly did you feel motivated to write on this particular topic?" But in fact, I have a pretty long history, nearly 20 years as well, of studying human sexuality and really the ways that Christians engage in public conversation around those kinds of issues that are both deeply personal and deeply public, right? I grew up in a mainline congregation. I'm the daughter of a United Methodist pastor. And when I was coming of age and in school, I noted at that time there was a real... I did not grow up in a particularly conservative congregation. It was very much mainline in the suburbs of Chicago. And we had a lot of conversation, not around sexuality or abortion necessarily, but certainly the big question at that time in our part of the church was around the inclusion of LGBTQI plus people. And so that was sort of the primary lens through which I started to understand sexuality. But at the same time, I graduated from high school in the same year that Joshua Harris published I Kissed Dating Goodbye. So I was a little old for that to be really, you know, that ship had sailed in terms of right. Don't date by the time that book came out for me. But that question about how do we sort of limit adolescent and young adult access to conversations around sexuality and their bodies? And how do we limit their sense of curiosity and exploration? That really was so very much in contrast to the Christian ethos with which I was raised. So in college, I actually looked in particular at the 96 welfare bill that had been passed as the focus of my senior work, and was looking at the ways this is an ostensibly an anti-poverty bill, but it was really founded on these sort of deeply conservative positions around marriage and the place of abstinence-only education as an approach. And that struck me as both deeply problematic for, you know, the law of the land, but also as really ineffective. That is not a good poverty prevention strategy. And it hasn't borne out that way over time. Anyway, then I went to graduate school, and as a preacher's kid, I had no interest in pursuing ministry for myself, but I was interested in theological questions. And so I did a Master's of Divinity, you know, the degree for ministry, and then also at the same time, a Master's in Public Policy. And in doing that, I really honed in on the intersection. I was working with a youth group at the time in a local congregation, and again, seeing a lot of federal money going to abstinence-only education programs in public schools, and also seeing a lot of churches that were sort of pursuing really more abstinence-based things, which again was not what I had grown up with, but was so much more widespread, it felt like, in terms of cultural impact. So at any rate, that was what I sort of studied in graduate school. And then, and as a Methodist, you know, in our social principles, we describe abortion as there are on occasion fundamental conflicts of life with life. And that was really my first theological understanding, that we have, you know, difficult and often tragic conflicts of life with life. And so that was my first lens. As time passed and serving in churches and on college campuses, my current congregation is right near a college campus as well, I became more and more convicted by the real lack of deep and meaningful conversation and resources for women and young people around the ways that their faith impacted and might influence their sexual understanding of themselves, sexual practice, and their, you know, reproductive health. So anyway, but yeah, as you know, I am definitely a generalist. I do not talk about abortion most of the days.
Well, I was going to say, and obviously, you know, just from everything you've said there, evidently, I would imagine on a whole range of subjects, take a different perspective to Stephanie and other Christians in the more evangelical sort of perspective. We'll come back to you in a moment, Bromley, to talk a little bit about the specific article you wrote and some of the ideas that I think are relevant to today's discussion. Before we do that, Stephanie, perhaps you could outline for those who aren't particularly familiar with it what this Texas Heartbeat Bill is and why it's caused so much controversy. Would you do that for us?
Sure. So the Texas Heartbeat Bill is really significant from a pro-life perspective because it goes very far in protecting preborn children almost from the entirety of their existence. It basically says that abortion cannot happen after a heartbeat has been detected. So people are talking about the six-week line. The bill does not say abortion is not allowed after 6 weeks. It says abortion is not allowed after a heartbeat has been detected. It just so happens that with technology, a heartbeat can typically be detected around 6 weeks of pregnancy. The heart actually begins to beat at 21 days after fertilization, which would be 3 weeks, but because pregnancy is typically calculated from the last menstrual period, 2 weeks before fertilization occurred, the 3 weeks plus two more weeks is going to be about 5 weeks. And so it's 5 to 6 weeks that a heartbeat can be detected. And so the general standard that people have is, look, if there's a living being with a heart, it would be wrong to bring that heart to a stop. And so therefore making the argument that abortion should not be allowed. But what's significant about it is it empowers the average person, not the government, to be able to respond to where the individual becomes aware that someone has been involved in breaking this law, so that a regular citizen could create a civil lawsuit against a abortion doctor or someone who aids and abets an abortion being committed. And therefore, that could cost the individual, you know, $10,000 or more. And so it is the fear amongst abortion supporters of being charged, you know, thousands of dollars and having to go to court and being sued that is causing them to therefore not want to do abortions beyond the detectable heartbeat, which therefore means preborn children will be saved from abortions that would otherwise have occurred had this law not been in existence.
So effectively, the law does not, as it were, penalize women who do end up having abortions. It is the providers, in a sense, who are liable if they get charged, if someone brings a case against them. I think that has happened indeed. I mean, in a way, I think someone sort of triggered it kind of almost deliberately. I think there has been a particular case that's going through at the moment, isn't there?
Now, that I'm not as familiar with, but it would make sense to me because that's the whole nature of the law. And it's, you know, there's a website people can go to start to make reports and claims. And again, as you pointed out, this is targeting the people who are committing the act of abortion very directly as the physician, or those who would aid and abet and facilitate the woman getting access to that abortion.
And can I assume you are generally in favor of this kind of, you know, more restrictive sort of legislation on abortion, Stephanie?
Absolutely. I'm very much in favor of the law. Now, of course, because science teaches us that life begins at fertilization, I think in an ideal world, abortion should be banned from the moment a human being comes into existence, which is sperm egg fusion, which is the moment of fertilization, which is 3 weeks before the heart begins to beat. However, because abortions happen beyond the heartbeat being detected, that a law like this, rather than introducing an evil, is decreasing the evil. It's making a bad situation better, and therefore it has my wholehearted support.
Okay. Bromley, so you're one among many women who have decried this particular change in the law. So just explain why. I mean, this may take a little while, obviously, because it's a big subject altogether. It's not just this specific law that I'm sure is at stake here. But yeah, what for you is the immediate consequences of something like this particular Texas heartbeat bill before we get to the wider issues around abortion?
There are, as you know, a number of challenging things. And honestly, I mean, a number of the communities in which I serve and relate to, colleagues and friends and members of my congregation, are frightened and worried. You know, this is very restrictive. And while, you know, folks who support this kind of legislation understand it to be preventing harm, there is very real harm being done to living women, currently living women, and so it is very frightening. There's also the sense that, you know, leaders in the in obstetrics and gynecology talk about how even the term heartbeat bill is a misnomer. I mean, I remember going for my first prenatal appointment with my first child and getting the sonogram and hearing that swishing noise and being so moved. But that's not really a heartbeat. It's an electrical impulse. A heartbeat is created when valves in a four-chamber human heart, well, I mean a human heartbeat anyway, open and close. And those valves simply don't exist at that point. The sound that you hear in the sonogram, which made me cry and be so delighted, is, you know, made by the sonogram machine. It's measuring something. And it's measuring something important, the beginning of the possibility of a human child. But there's a real clear sense that that language of heartbeat is being used to create emotional support for legislation like this. So that feels manipulative, yeah. I think.
What for you are the kind of key problems? I mean, it may, just to make it completely obvious, what for you are the detrimental aspects that this will have on women as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think access to abortion as a legal and well-supported healthcare practice, part of women's reproductive health, is hugely detrimental any time you limit that. Also, as someone who is concerned about people's access to care based on their income, the state where they live, their race and age, their position of privilege, this has a much greater impact on particularly women, but other folks who lack other resources. And so, you know, as someone who's concerned about unequal outcomes, that's a huge problem. You know, you can always travel to a more liberal state if you have the means, but if you don't, yeah, then here you are. There are also no exceptions for rape or incest, which is I don't even understand. You know, there's this sense that there is no there that that carrying a pregnancy that is brought about by those instances doesn't further the harm that a person has already suffered, doesn't magnify the trauma that they've experienced. And in my experience, that is very much not the case.
Right. Well, let's pass back to you, Stephanie, just for a little while. I mean, a few points there possibly to start with responding to before we get to sort of the more general questions. But in this case, it's bad for women, says Bromley, not least because of there are apparently no exceptions to it. And it's also manipulative as far as she's concerned to use this language of heartbeat. It's not really a heartbeat and so on. What perhaps a response to both of those points?
Sure. Well, if you look at biology, it is the start of the heart. But as with all of our bodily functions, they don't, occur right away, there's a timing to it. There's a progression, there's a development. So there's no denying that the heart needs to develop more, but nonetheless, there is a heartbeat. And there seems to be an acknowledgement that there is a life there, because even if we look at the language Bromley used about her own pregnancy, talking about when I was pregnant, she said, with my first child. And so that's implying that that was a child there. She speaks about the law being harmful to, she used the terms, living women. But therefore, what about the living child? And any law that would permit abortion is harmful to the living child. So the law that says you may not end a life after there is a beating heart is not being manipulative. In fact, justifying abortion on the grounds that a woman has a right to it is actually being manipulative, because it's misleading people as to biology, as to what pregnancy is. You know, a woman who gets a negative pregnancy test never goes to an abortion clinic, because she knows with a negative test, it's just her body. If it's the positive test that's telling her, oh my gosh, I want to go to an abortion clinic, that's also telling her it's no longer just your body, that there is another body there. So I think when we speak of things that Bromley referenced, such as healthcare, and speaking about abortion in terms of women having access to healthcare, abortion is the exact opposite of healthcare. Health is a state of how the body ought to be. And pregnancy is a sign that the body is working correctly. Therefore, abortion is the opposite of health, because it's directly and intentionally ending a state that has naturally and rightly occurred as a sign of a body functioning correctly and in a healthy manner. And care is about the opposite of harm. It's about preserving and protecting. And so maintaining a pregnancy is care. It's preserving and protecting the life and the relationship of the mother and child, whereas abortion is the opposite of care, because it's dismembering and decapitating the very body of one's own child.
I mean, we'll just take a couple of minutes and then we'll go to a break. But I mean, we've got to the heart of one of the key issues, you know, at an ethical sort of level here, Bromley, which is simply that Stephanie says you are dealing with a human, and therefore whatever hardships may be for a woman, and unless I suppose perhaps unless it's in a life-threatening one, that you can't dispose of this person. So do you just simply take a different view on whether we are talking about a living human being? You talked about your own child, you know, and so on. You lose the language that we would associate with that being a living human being, but is that not specifically the way you would think about these cases?
Well, so even at that, I mean, yes, I think we have a very clear difference of opinion on when fully human life begins. And that is, and you know, there is a broad range of understandings of that within the Christian tradition and within other religious traditions. Traditionally in Judaism, human life doesn't begin until you draw your first breath. And so that is one of the reasons why you see a lot of pro-choice rabbis. So, and there was actually a deeply compelling article after the Texas law passed by a Texas rabbi who wrote about how this law was infringing on his practice of religion. But anyway, so I think that a lot of the difference does come down to this, you know, when does human life exist? And I believe that, as you say, it happens gradually, right? Things develop over time. I think the point of viability is a huge and important marker, because until then, it's not my life and this other life. It's one life. And the person who is carrying the pregnancy, I think, is really the only person who can have authority and responsibility for making the ultimate decisions about those shared bodies. Until that child can survive, you know, until a child can survive on its own, it is only the potential for a child. And if you have longed for a pregnancy, if you have planned for a pregnancy, if you have undergone reproductive health procedures in order to gain and maintain a pregnancy, then clearly you are imbuing that life with meaning and value well before that time. I wanted a baby. I was sad the first time that the pregnancy test came back negative, but it was just too soon to tell. And, you know, because I wanted to be pregnant. But that's a very different response than for someone who is deeply afraid of being pregnant because of a whole host of things. And really, I think the crux of it comes down to who can make the decision. Who gets to make the decision? And it's my sense that pregnant people have to make that choice.
We'll come back to this. Stephanie Gray Connors and Bromley McClenahan joining me, Justin Briley, on today's Unbelievable, debating abortion law and the Texas heartbeat bill. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Briley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show. We're talking about abortion law on Unbelievable today. My two guests are Stephanie Gray Connors and Bromley McClenahan. Stephanie, founder of the pro-life charity Love Unleashes Life. Reverend Bromley McClenahan, church minister in the USA, who's a pro-choice minister and wrote an article for the Washington Post a couple of years ago on that, believing we should that clergy should speak up more as in terms of pro-choice. We'll come to some of those more specifically Christian religious issues. We're kind of diving straight in, though, to the ethical questions of what constitutes a human life and life in the womb and that sort of thing. And in that last segment, Bromley saying that for her, it's about viability, Stephanie. It's about, you know, as long as the baby is in some sense dependent on the mother, that is part of the mother. There's a kind of sense in which the mother has a right to choose what to do with their body in that kind of instance. I hear that argument quite a lot. What's your response to that kind of way of looking at it? This is only potentially a child until a certain line is crossed in that sense.
Sure. I think it prompts the question, are human rights, particularly the most foundational of all, which is the right to life, is the right to life grounded in what you are or how old you are, or how developed you are, or how strong you are? Because viability is about your age. It's about your development. It's about your maturity and therefore your strength. But human rights aren't grounded in those things. Human rights are grounded in the question, are you a member of the human family? Are you of the species Homo sapiens? And because the pregnant woman is human, because her partner is human, the only thing their offspring can be from the moment of fertilization onwards is of their same species, is also a human being. Yes, that preborn child is more dependent than the adults are. The preborn child is less developed than the adults are, but the preborn child is human and therefore ought to have the same rights as you or me. This idea of viability, we also need to realize, is dependent on technology as well as where in the world you are. So we have the technology to keep a baby alive in an incubator at 24, even down to 21 weeks after fertilization of pregnancy. But there was a time, you know, 200 years ago where we didn't even have incubators to keep babies alive then. Maybe it was only at, you know, 35 weeks, if that at all. And therefore, does that mean abortion would be okay up until that point? Or we have babies that can survive in the United States in incubators, but if you're, you know, in a jungle somewhere else in the world and you don't have access to incubators, then the viability of the preborn child is very different. But the question is the child still human? And this idea of dependency, you know, because the child needs the mom's body to survive, the idea being that therefore that justifies abortion. I can say as a mother of a two-month-old that my newborn child very much is dependent on my body for survival. And the impact of my born child on my body and my life in some ways is more significant than when the child was in my womb. You know, when I was pregnant, I could just hop in the car and go anywhere and do anything. Now I could have plans to go somewhere and my baby have a poopy diaper, or suddenly my child starts screaming and I think, there goes that plan. We're not leaving the house. I have to, you know, use my body to take care of my child, provide my breast for breast milk. I'm supplementing with formula, use my arms to hold a bottle to feed the baby. I am using my body so significantly to keep my born child alive. And we would never say because my born child is entirely dependent on my body to survive that it would be okay to kill my born child. So therefore, likewise, when that same child is entirely dependent on my body as a preborn child, we should never say that that gives me license to end that child's life.
I wouldn't say that the question is dependency. I think there's both particularity and shared identity, right? God forbid something were to happen to you, or, you know, less God forbidding, you just needed to go out. Someone else could care for your child. But before the point of viability, no one but the person carrying the child can care, can provide the environment that the child or the fetus, the however you're using your language, no one else can provide that. And so I think that, and it is incredible. You know, I hesitate to use the word burden, you know, but it is incredibly taxing on a woman's body to carry a child, right? I mean, even when everything goes well, I was exhausted, right? I had very healthy pregnancies and I was exhausted all the time. I couldn't do my work the way that I normally do. And again, that was something that I was sort of willing to do because I really wanted to carry pregnancies and have biological children. But I didn't consider those lives separate from mine. And they weren't. Until they were born, they were a part of me. And so it's not for me about asking, do we have the right to infringe on the rights of someone? It's how can I make a choice about this part of me that is right for us? And when there are conflicts, when the potential for this human child is there, and, you know, and our needs and our hopes are in alignment, that's a wonderful gift. But there are myriad occasions for millions of women around the world where there is that conflict. And so it seems disingenuous to me to suggest that women can't and shouldn't make those decisions about such a critically important part of themselves.
Sure. So a couple thoughts come to mind. I can relate, Bromley. I also overall had a very healthy pregnancy, but like you, I also was exhausted. And I remember thinking at the very end of my pregnancy, like, I just want the baby to be out. And then after the baby was born, boy, did I discover a whole new world of exhaustion. When I was pregnant, you know, barring getting up in the night just to go to the bathroom, I could get right back into bed and go to sleep. That is not my reality anymore. I'm up multiple times a night for an hour or more at a time feeding my baby girl, which is an honor, a privilege, and a delight to do. But my point is that there is so much that we have to involve our bodies, our energy, and so forth with caring for a born child. And we never justify ending that child's life because of that, so therefore we shouldn't when the child is just a little younger. Now, if I heard you correctly, it sounds like you're saying the difference is that anyone could care for my baby girl who's now born, but when I was pregnant with her, only I could care for her at that point. I agree with you that that is true. Only I can care for the child in my womb versus anyone could care for the child who is born. But the conclusion you've come to that justifies abortion flies in the face of what any civil society holds as a reasonable standard, which is that the more vulnerable someone is and the more they're dependent on another person, that typically heightens that person's responsibility. It doesn't lessen it. So, for example, if I'm a specialist in first aid and I know the Heimlich maneuver is someone's choking. And I'm in a restaurant where someone's choking and there's a whole table of paramedics also in the restaurant. And if someone begins to choke and the paramedics get up and help that person and I do nothing, I have done nothing wrong by my inaction because there were other people who could help the choking person. So my responsibility for them is lessened. But if I am alone with a choking person and they begin to choke and I know how to help them and I don't help them and no one else is around to help them, we actually would say my inaction in that case is a very serious crime that I have refused to help someone who was entirely and solely dependent on me. So the dependency of one individual entirely on another heightens our responsibility rather than lessening it. So you're correct that that my baby, when she was in my womb, was totally dependent on me. But the conclusion that fact should bring us to is that abortion ought to be rejected rather than embraced.
I'm curious about this sense that of personhood separate from the pregnant individual. What do you make of that? Because to me, that really is the crux of it. I mean, that... I mean, I hear that, you know, but we also don't try or penalize women. Well, no, I shouldn't say that, because we do in some states penalize women for miscarriage or if they are addicts or if they don't have access to reproductive health care. There are communities and states where there are, you know, laws that penalize women for those behaviors. But
one question I was hearing in particular, and one point that perhaps Stephanie hadn't yet responded to, that seems to be at the nub of this, Bromley, for you, is that you don't distinguish a separate life when the pregnancy is happening. You say it's all of a piece. It's one life. And that's why you feel the woman has the right to essentially choose to sustain it or to end that sort of life that is part and parcel of her own life at that point. So, Stephanie, does that change the dynamic there? I mean, the fact that as far as Bromley can see, it is different because there's a kind of interwovenness almost of yes, what are two separate bodies essentially, but obviously very much conjoined in this significant way during pregnancy.
Well, certainly the preborn child is in the mother's body and dependent on the mother's body, but in no way could we logically or reasonably come to the conclusion that the child is the mother's body. The child in the womb has a separate set of DNA, all the different body parts, you know, so a woman doesn't suddenly have four arms. She still has two arms. It just so happens there's another life within her body that also has two arms. If she's pregnant with a male child, she doesn't suddenly have a penis, but the child who is male does. And so clearly there are two separate bodies. So I think the question then becomes, when you have two bodies so intricately connected, what is the responsibility of the stronger body, the stronger party? And clearly the woman is the stronger party. And who is the woman? She's not just any woman. She is the mother to the child. And so we have to ask ourselves is what responsibility do civil societies expect of mothers to their offspring? And clearly there is a widespread consensus that mothers and fathers have a responsibility to care for and nurture their offspring, not end their offspring's lives, which is why if you come across a news headline that talks about, you know, parents starving or torturing their children, there's universal outrage and horror at that, not just because an innocent child was harmed, but because an innocent child was harmed at the hands of the parents. Because there's this expectation that parents have to care for and protect their children. So the child in the womb is attached to the mother, but is a separate individual. And I think it's important to realize if someone were to make the argument that because the child is in the mom's body and attached to the mom's body, that gives her license to have an abortion, then such an individual is saying essentially that abortion should be allowed through all 9 months of pregnancy, which most people recoil at, because at the 8th month of pregnancy, at the 9th month of pregnancy, the child is still in the mom's body and dependent on the mom's body at that point until the child is out. And so those individuals would have to, you know, welcome and embrace late-term abortion, which horrifies a lot of people. But then if we say that we would ban or oppose late-term abortion, then we're saying there comes a point where we recognize you can be in a body and dependent on the body, but we override your desire to have an abortion on the basis that it's a separate life. Well, the point is it's a separate life the whole time that an individual with a separate set of DNA has come into existence, which science says is fertilization.
Well, I definitely clarified the difference between reaching the point of viability and an abortion prior to that. You know, if the fetus can survive outside of the womb, then that is usually what folks do, right? I mean, late-term abortion is so rare in terms of the percentage of abortions that are done. And I think, you know, that harkens back to what is so frustrating about the Texas abortion law is that here this is, and again, I mean, we can disagree and probably will, right, as the day is long about when human life begins. But as you point out, you know, folks really recoil much more strongly about the idea of later term abortions than they do earlier. Wouldn't it be better if this was a necessary thing, if this was for whatever reason that the woman deems necessary for her and her body, isn't it better to have an abortion sooner rather than later? And why make that so difficult to access? And to that end, and I think this is the whole one of your questions, Justin, that you sent along. You know, what is so frustrating is that there are so many ways to decrease the number of abortions, including comprehensive sex ed and making contraception widely available and providing resources to prevent unwanted pregnancies. So again, that's what is so frustrating about laws that make it increasingly difficult for women to exercise this constitutionally protected right.
A brief response, Stephanie, and then I'll move us on to some of the other sort of legal and religious questions as well that we wanted to get to in this program. But yeah, brief response, and then we'll go on to some of those.
Sure. When you ask, or the questioner make the point, you know, wouldn't it be better to do abortion earlier rather than later? What's really at the heart of what you're asking is this idea that isn't it better if the victim is younger rather than older? And so I would come back to my earlier point about human rights. Human rights are grounded in being human. That's why if we talk about women's rights, the people who get the rights are women. If we talk about children's rights, the people who get the rights are children. Therefore, if we talk about human rights, the people who get the rights are human. All you need to have the rights is to fit into the category of human. It doesn't matter how old you are, what your ethnicity is, what your beliefs are, or so forth. So if we believe in human rights, then you have the right regardless of your age. So to say that it would be better to, you know, kill a preborn child at 10 weeks pregnancy than it would be at 30 weeks pregnancy is to imply the morality of the act is grounded in the age of the victim. And so what I would say is that the morality of the act is grounded in what is the act doing and is it inflicting direct and intentional harm or death upon an innocent human being. And therefore, because we know in pregnancy we have an innocent human being, again, I mentioned the fact that the child has to be of the same species as the parents. Beings that reproduce sexually begin their lives at fertilization. No one debates that when we're talking about dogs or cats, which reproduce sexually. We know their offspring come into existence at sperm egg fusion. And so the same is true for human beings who are a type of a species that reproduces sexually. So therefore, once you are a member of the species and you have started your growth and development, your rights are grounded in being a member of the human family, not how old you are. And even the United Nations says that, you know, in its Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it says everyone has the right to life. And then everyone is defined in the preamble of that document as all members of the human family. And then in Article 6, they talk about personhood and say everyone has a right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. well, who's everyone? Everyone is all members of the human family. So the UN is essentially saying, if you're a member of the human family, you ought to be considered a person. And so since preborn children biologically are members of the human family, they are persons and they're separate persons from their mother and therefore should be cared for by their mothers, not have their heart stopped by them.
Well, look, we'll leave the ethical issue there for the moment. I'm happy to return to it, Bromley, if you want to. But I did want to get onto the fact that, you know, I had you both on the show partly because you are both Christians, but obviously take very different perspectives on this particular issue. Now, up to this point, what's been debated so far could just have easily taken place between two secular people who simply disagree on you know, the issues around when life begins and that sort of thing. Well, let's start with you on this one, Bromley. This article you wrote for the Washington Post a couple of years ago when the Alabama proposed restrictions were coming around, you said actually you think there's more clergy out there that are actually pro-choice than is often imagined, and certainly more people in the pews who are, but they don't tend to speak up. So tell us why that is, and why you think they should be speaking up more if they do essentially hold to a pro-choice position.
I think after, you know, 20 years in ministry, I finally am serving in a congregation where I feel like I can say what I need to say on any given social justice issue. I have had the experience in many other congregations where speaking on issues that have political ramifications or partisan divisions around them can cause a good deal of consternation and disagreement, right? We're a volunteer organization and we are funded by those in our pews. And, you know, clergy want their folks to, you know, pay. So anyway, I think there's a real concern about angering donors, right? And so we steer clear of a whole host of things, not just this, but you know, common sense gun laws and whether or not we can proclaim proudly that Black Lives Matter or that people of all genders and sexualities ought to have full inclusion, or in some contexts that women ought to be able to serve in ministry. You know, I mean, there's a whole host of controversial issues depending on what your context is. And clergy generally shy away from them. I think that there has been, you know, a real sense that things that are, you hear all the time from certain folks, you know, that I don't want to hear politics from the pulpit. So I think that is why folks don't talk about it. There's a sense of angering folks. And there's also a recognition that when you are in the pulpit, you have a certain amount of power, right? Folks are not going to interrupt you. They may get up and leave, but and it is important to use that responsibly. You don't get into the pulpit and say things to try to make people upset, right? That is, there are good ways to change hearts and minds, and preaching about them is not always one of them, even though that is, you know, one of the more public ways that we have of communicating.
And to that extent, I mean, would you say then that you're more likely to hear, you know, clergy who are giving sermons or whatever that are pro-life as opposed to pro-choice, or does people simply not approach the subject whatsoever most of the
time?
Well,
yeah, definitely, because that I think really, you know, largely applies to mainline or progressive congregations, right? Evangelical, and particularly around the issue of abortion, Catholic churches tend to not have the same qualms about that. So that's one factor. I do think, though, I mean, that clergy walk with folks in the complexity of their lives, in their daily ethical decision making around the points of suffering and hope and longing and fear. And when you hear stories from people, you start to notice over time, if you're paying attention and listening well, that a lot of these, you know, public issues where people take firm stands are really a lot more complex and really depend quite a bit on context. And I think that experience, you know, informs clergy opinions.
What's your experience, Stephanie, on this? Do you find generally, well, I suppose it does depend on your context, and I'm sure in the vast majority of Catholic cases that there's a very much a pro-life view, but generally across the spectrum of the church, especially in the USA, would you say that by and large, you know, Christians in the pew and in the pulpit will be, you know, taking a pro-life stance and indeed willing to speak out on that front? Or do you ever hear, you know, is Bromley a rare exception to that in that sense?
I would say it's definitely mixed, and it is largely dependent on the denomination, whether the churchgoer or the pastor is in favor of abortion or not. There are certainly people that claim the name of Christ who would embrace abortion, but I would say that if you look at what it means to be a Christian and to be a follower of Christ, it's impossible to be that and hold those views and therefore embrace abortion, because abortion is the exact opposite of a basic tenet of Christianity, which is, first of all, that all human lives are valuable. I mean, we know from the story of creation, everything God made was good until he came to humans. And then when he made Adam and Eve, it was suddenly his analysis of creation was it was very good. And then we also know, you know, the famous scripture passage, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever might believe in him shall not perish but have eternal life." In other words, humans are so valuable to God that he was willing to suffer and be crucified, die, and rise from the dead, so that instead of having eternal separation from God, we could be reunited with him. So that's how valuable humans are to God, so valuable that he's willing to die for us. And therefore, if we're to be a follower of Christ, a follower of God, then we have to value human life the way he does. And so therefore, because science tells us we have human life from the moment of fertilization onwards, then the Christian belief that humans are very good and that they ought to be valued and protected and rescued applies to the case of the preborn.
What about these points Bromley made earlier then, that in her view, it's not clear from the Bible that there is a specific, you know, that life starts from conception, and that, you know, there is this tradition in Judaism that actually it is actually from birth even, and hence, you know, you do get a certain number of rabbis who are pro-choice. I'm sure Bromley would agree with you that every human life matters, but I suppose the question is, does the Bible describe exactly when such a human life begins?
So I would say we look to science to tell us when we have a human life, and we look to the scriptures to tell us how we ought to treat that human life. So because we know we have a human life at the moment of fertilization, then the scriptural command to love your neighbor as you love yourself, to love the least of these when someone is vulnerable, you know, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was naked, I was in prison, you gave me food, you gave me drink, you rescued me, you visited me, and so forth. The idea there is when you're vulnerable, when you're on the verge of death, I ought to rescue you. In Proverbs, we're told, rescue those being dragged to the slaughter, hold back those stumbling to their death. So the scriptures don't need to specifically spell out that abortion is wrong, the way the scriptures don't specifically spell out killing your neighbor with a machete, as was the case in the Rwandan genocide, is wrong. The specific method of killing doesn't need to be spelled out. What is spelled out is that we ought not kill our neighbor. We ought not kill our fellow human. So the moment we realize the victim of the Rwandan genocide is human, then we know the scriptural commands apply there. The moment we say, okay, science says life begins at fertilization, then we know the scriptural commands to value life apply there. But I would say the scriptures are very clear that we have life at fertilization, because when God decided to enter into the human experience in the form of Jesus, he didn't enter earth, you know, as a 30-year-old at the, you know, the first of his 3 years of public ministry. He didn't enter earth as a 12-year-old, you know, in the temple who was found, you know, asking questions and talking to the crowd. He didn't enter earth even as an infant in a stable in Bethlehem. When God entered into the human experience as Jesus Christ, he did so as an embryo, as a tiny, vulnerable human being in the body of his mother. And when Mary went to visit Elizabeth and John the Baptist, the late-term fetus, leapt in Elizabeth's womb for joy, He did so because when Mary entered the home, she didn't enter alone. She entered, in a sense, as a walking tabernacle with God in her body in the form of Jesus as a first trimester embryo who probably hadn't even implanted yet. And so if God entered into the human experience as an embryo, he's showing us that life begins then, and that is the start of what it means to be a human being.
We're going to go to another final break and we'll conclude the discussion today. Stephanie Gray Connors and Bromley McLenahan joining me to debate abortion law. We've started with the Texas heartbeat bill, but we're talking about sort of how this plays out in scriptural terms, and we'll come back to Bromley in just a moment as we conclude today's discussion here on Unbelievable.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Don't forget, we'll be giving out the ways to get in touch and hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. And if you enjoy Unbelievable, you may enjoy some of the other podcast offerings that come from the Unbelievable stable these days, including the C.S. Lewis podcast. Another season of that has just started to air with Ruth Jackson interviewing, as ever, Alistair McGrath, who is probably the world's leading C.S. Lewis expert. At the moment, they're going through the Narnia stories. So go and check that out. If you're a podcast listener, the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath is what you're looking at. And then there's also, of course, the weekly Ask N.T. Wright Anything show that I host with theologian and Bible scholar N.T. Wright, asking all kinds of questions of him that people send in. In fact, Adam Otto on Twitter said that he's found both Unbelievable and Ask N.T. Wright Anything really helpful as podcasts. You say, I like these podcasts for their ease of listening to and introduction to subjects that lead me to finding authors that I want to read and study more. Thank you very much, Adam, for tweeting me that. Do share today's podcast if you're listening that way. Rate and review us as well on iTunes. That helps other people to discover the show as well. Next week on the program, this really is an autumn of cultural and ethical debates, because next week we're asking, is the church too woke or just broke? Owen Strachan, well, he's not actually pronounced Strachan, I've discovered, it's Owen Strahan, is author of Christianity and Wokeness, How the Social Justice Movement is Hijacking the Gospel and the Way to Stop It. Well, he'll be coming on opposite the Reverend Jermaine Marshall, author of Christianity Corrupted, The Scandal of White Supremacy. Now, Owen's book deals at length with critical race theory, so this should be an interesting one. Just about a year on, actually, from when we last really debated that subject with Russell Berry and Neil Shenvey. So that's next week's show. Do come back for that at the same time next week. Later on tonight on The Profile, you'll be hearing my conversation with the Reverend Giles Fraser, all about his own journey of rediscovering his Jewish roots as told in his recent book Chosen. And he's a fascinating character. So if you perhaps listened to our big conversation between Giles Fraser and Amy Jill Levine when we discussed Judaism and Christianity, this is really a chance to hear more of Giles's own story, his political journey, his views on wokeness and all kinds of other things in this particular discussion. So look out for that on The Profile tonight at 8 p.m. or on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. Let's get back into the final part of today's discussion. Do make sure to check out both my guests from today's show. LoveUnleashesLife.com is where you can find out more about Stephanie Gray Connors and her books and her speaking and so on. You can find out more about Bromley McLenahan as well. She's got a Facebook page where you can find out more about her. I'll make sure to link to that from today's show at Bromley M if you're looking out on Twitter. They've both delivered talks at Google, which you can look up as well online. Yeah, just in that last segment, and we're going to have to start to begin to wrap the show up now. But Bromley, Stephanie was saying, you know, the fact that God became an embryo in the person of Jesus Christ is pretty significant when it comes to the value God ascribes and the point at which life begins in that sense. And yes, there are other arguments she's made as well, just from the fact of science, you know, that at a scientific level, we know that life begins at the moment of conception. There's a separate human that is there at that point, albeit far less developed than an adult human. What's your response, I suppose, both on the scientific and that biblical argument for life?
It's interesting to read and to go between the different sources of knowledge, right? To say, well, from science, we know this. And so then we can ascribe, based on what we know from science, this to this one gospel account, which is not a scientific account. There's a really interesting blending of sources of knowledge and understanding there. I think that God longs for human flourishing. I think God desires that both individually and collectively. I think that humans are so fascinating, right? Because, I mean, here we are, what is man? Psalm 8 goes, right? God has made them little less than angels, and yet so much less than so much. And yet we are also the ones who create so much harm in the world. We do violence on one another in ways that other species don't. We do violence against the creation in ways that other species don't. And so I do believe that God longs for human flourishing, that God calls us to care for the vulnerable, certainly, and to examine always who has power, and to be asking always, who is my neighbor and who is my brother? But I also am not convinced that the Bible is clear that human life, that the life that is in utero is the same as the life of a living child or a woman. And I do believe that part of human flourishing is inviting folks into care and offering resources and providing them and also reducing suffering. And I would be so much more compelled by those lawmakers, for example, in Texas, and they're talking about it here in Florida, God help us. And, you know, if there was that sense that that call to human flourishing, that call to the reduction of suffering, that call to fullness of life was evidenced in any of their other laws for any other populations. I mean, we see anti-immigrant rhetoric. We see, again, anti-sex ed legislation. We see, you know, laws that downgrade the violence done against women through sexual assault. We deny folks resources because they don't have economic privilege or because of who they were, you know, because of their race, gender, and sexuality. There have been, oh wait, I got one more. There have been 4 votes taken in the Texas legislature this year against transgender kids. Transgender kids who are awfully vulnerable. And so it is, again, it is hard to believe the rhetoric that comes out of the folks who are passing these kinds of laws, because it doesn't reflect. Yeah.
And in that sense, what I hear sometimes, and perhaps this, you know, a way of putting it is that you can't just be pro-life on this issue. You have to be pro-life on all kinds of issues. You have to be willing to allow humans to flourish in that sort of way. I mean, Stephanie, you know, and if I could put this to you as well, I think there is evidence that, in fact, it's the number of abortions have actually gone down under more quote unquote progressive governments. So that actually critics will sometimes say actually the best way to reduce the number of abortions is not to have more restrictive abortion law. It's to actually increase the welfare available to people who, you know, need it and so on. And that's practically speaking the best way. What do you make of those kinds of arguments that actually you're kind of focusing on the wrong thing? I'm sure Bromley's no more a fan of people getting abortions in a sense than you are. She would rather people didn't feel they had to go that route if they could avoid it. But But many people would say they wouldn't have to go that route if you know, the pro-life lobby, you know, turned their attention to just improving the situation of women around the USA. Again, I'm just giving an argument that I've heard. So what do you say to that kind of argument, Stephanie?
Mm-hmm. You know, I would say that if you look at, for example, in places where abortion was illegal and then made legal, you always see an increase in numbers. I mean, there have been over 50 million abortions in America since it became legal. There weren't that many before when it was illegal. So where it is legalized, you generally see it increase because there are some people who just won't go down the path of abortion if it's against the law. The moment it's kind of validated by society, it increases the odds of people saying, hey, there's less risk to me because I won't be breaking a law, so therefore I'm going to pursue this remedy. So, you know, when we talk about the need to essentially provide for the welfare of others and to support human flourishing, of course I agree with human flourishing, but therefore abortion, which commits homicide on the youngest of our kind, isn't human flourishing, it's human destruction. We need to help women in crisis, and that's why the pro-life movement, you know, across the world supports women through pregnancy help centers and homes for pregnant women. There's an order of nuns in New York called the Sisters of Life who actually let pregnant women and their children live in their convent with them. So there's a lot that the pro-life movement has done to not only help preborn children, but help their mothers in crisis. But I would say at the end of the day, simply offering help isn't going to necessarily end abortion, which is why we need to change the hearts of people, provide education, as well as change the law. As I mentioned, I'm originally Canadian, and Canada is known for being more of a socialist society, much like the UK, you know, more welfare, more government involvement, government support. We have the same abortion rate in Canada as there is in the United States. Abortions are fully funded by the Canadian government in a way they aren't in the United States. And so, therefore, that shows us simply offering a type of welfare society and government funding isn't going to reduce abortion, because between these two countries, essentially, the abortion rate is the same.
Just before we finish up, I mean, what would you like to see, Stephanie? I mean, this takes us into the complexities of US law, but would you like to see Roe versus Wade, which I think was the, you know, that decision kind of paved the way for abortion across the whole of the US in a way. Would you like to see that overturned? Is that possible? Would it actually have the effect of actually, you know, would that simply just turn it into a localized matter when it came to different states and their approach to abortion?
Good point. So certainly I would say, as someone who looks to the science and believes in human rights, that Roe v. Wade ought to be overturned so the youngest of our kind can be protected. I'm very much aware of the fact that if that were to happen, or when that happens, that it will move to the states. And if you're in a more conservative state, preborn children will be protected. If you're more in a more liberal state, they won't be protected by the law. So I think at the end of the day, while I believe abortion ought to be illegal, I have kind of made my whole career built around the premise that abortion ought to be unthinkable, that we should educate people about the humanity of the preborn child and the support for women through their pregnancy and beyond, so that when faced with crisis, regardless of what the law says, it doesn't enter into the hearts and minds of a woman or her partner in crisis to end the life of their preborn child. And instead, they seek support and help through the pregnancy and beyond, whether with parenting or adoption. So ultimately, I think unthinkable is the path we need to go to. But of course, I believe we need to be consistent. So since we have laws against killing the born, I think we should have laws against killing the preborn as well.
Bromley, we are out of time. So just chance for final thoughts. And I'll just let you say whatever you want to as we start to wrap up today's show.
I think that this is such an important topic. And, you know, I started as a child when I was watching the 88 presidential debates with my parents. I was like, what is abortion? And my dad said, it's a tragic solution for a tragic problem, right? And it's interesting because my youngest is 6 now, and we were talking about the Texas law. We're a political sort of household. And she said, what's abortion? And I said, it's a healthcare decision that sometimes people who are pregnant have to make. And I think that for me, all of my years of experience as a woman and as a religious leader, as someone trying to be faithful and care for folks wherever they find themselves – I am the ways that I have understand the issue of abortion have changed and grown, and I think reflect that complexity. And I think that's important. So I long for a day when our laws can reflect the complexity of the human experience and give the authority to women for their bodies and their children or not children.
Hmm. Stephanie, final thoughts from you as we close out?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves, do we believe all humans are equal? And if we do, then the question becomes, when does human begin their life? Because if we can identify that moment, then our equality begins when we begin. And Brumley hasn't refuted the science of life beginning at fertilization. All she's pointed out is that after fertilization, yes, there's a developmental change, there's a dependency change, a viability, you know, change, whether you can survive or not outside the womb. But clearly we are talking about a human being, and a human being who's a child of his or her parents. And so I would just appeal to anyone listening to realize that no matter how difficult someone's circumstances may be, the question is, what is the most ethical response to those difficult circumstances? So whether someone is poor, they have perhaps no family support, they're trying to, you know, just provide for their family, they're pursuing their career or their education, or perhaps they've conceived as a result of sexual assault, which was the case of a friend of mine, Leanna Rebolito. In each of these circumstances, pro-life and pro-abortion can agree those are difficult, challenging, horrible circumstances to be in. What we want to ask ourselves is, if we believe in human equality, shouldn't we find a way to help people in those circumstances that don't involve creating another victim, that don't involve harming the youngest of our kind?
Thank you both for a really open, hearted and frank discussion on these issues. Much more that we could have said, but time's finished. Thank you very much, Bromley and Stephanie, for being with me today. Do make sure to check out links from today's show to both Stephanie's website and where you can find out more about Bromley as well. But for now, Stephanie and Bromley, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd be delighted to hear what you think of the issues we've been discussing on the show today. Do email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I see all the emails that come in to the show email address. I can't respond to all of them. I do read them all, and we'll be hearing a few of them in just a moment's time. You can also get in touch, of course, via our social media at unbelievablejb for my Twitter account, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the show page on Facebook. And you can also find me over at Justin.Briley on Instagram and TikTok too. Just wanted to let you know about an exciting lecture series coming up. It's all online on Zoom. It's put on by our friends at the Christian Evidence Society. Earlier in the year, they hosted this as well, but they're repeating it. Questions of Our Time. It's happening from the 2nd of November every Tuesday through to the 30th of November. So there'll be five of these Tuesday night sessions, 8 p.m. here in the UK, on Zoom, and some fantastic guests that they've got for these lecture series, and which will involve Q&A from the Zoom audience. Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, Are We Alone in the Universe? Professor Barbara Drossel, Are We Here by Accident? Reverend John Bell, How is COVID Affecting Creativity? Professor Mary Ellen Foster, Will a Robot Steal My Job? And rounding out the series, Professor Alistair McGrath, Should We Always Follow the Science? If you want more details on that, they're completely free to attend these lecture series, Questions of Our Time. Go to christianevidence.org. That's christianevidence.org. Again, that'll be on Tuesday nights in November. At 8 p.m. in the UK. If you're on Eastern time, that's about 3 p.m. in the USA, but well worth getting along to that lecture series if you can. Let's go to some of your feedback to recent editions of the show. This one from John actually was responding to a recent classic replay, which featured Alistair McGrath and Stephen Law in discussion. And John said he really appreciated that last flashback episode. It was fantastic. Thanks for sharing it. I Googled Harris and torture and couldn't see anything on him on this theme since around the time that episode was aired. Long live Unbelievable, says John. Thank you. Yes, Sam Harris did come up in that conversation on atheism between Law and McGrath that we re-aired. I hope you're enjoying, by the way, the classic replays we're putting out on basically every Tuesday from the Unbelievable podcast archive. Do let me know what you think of those as we you know, pull out some of those classics from past years. Alvin Plantinga and, again, Stephen Law were also recently featured in the classic replays. And Nate got in touch to say on this subject that they were debating the evolutionary argument against naturalism that Plantinga is well known for. Nate said, "Hello, Justin. I'm a math teacher living in the US. Love listening. As a missionary kid, turned agnostic, turned back to Christianity, thoroughly enjoy engaging with the ideas. And I'm writing in response to the episode with Plantinga and Law. I've been turning that conversation over and over. And here are some thoughts. Firstly, just to summarize Plantinga's argument, if Darwinian materialistic evolution is true, there is no reason to assume that our logical faculties lead us to the truth. All we could assume is that these faculties are fit, that is, they help lead us to survive and reproduce. If they thus cannot be relied upon to lead us to truth, anything we believe we have come to know through these faculties is suspect, including Darwinian evolution. Number two, thoughts. Humans all over the world come to conclusions through logic that are not in fact true, but help them mightily in the world. The belief in karma, for example, may lead a human to live more conscientiously and carefully, which would most likely benefit them in their relationships and professional life. Belief in haunted houses keeps people out of structurally unsafe buildings. The ancient Jews believed eating pork or shellfish or not washing hands, etc., were an affront to God, but it protected them from foodborne illnesses and other problems caused by small organisms. Even as a Christian, I can see that were my religion false, it would still confer massive fitness to my life, gives me community, centers my life around gratitude and forgiveness, eases existential angst, etc. Even the most intelligent people are prone to this. The fact that so many of the brightest minds, and therefore the sharpest logical faculties, differ so extremely in so many of their beliefs seems to be more proof that our logical faculties are more used to find good reasons for what they already think than to actually know the truth. I try not to do this, but it's so hard to not listen to an Unbelievable episode and harshly pick apart the atheist argument while letting the Christian slide. And I'm sure the reverse is true for many atheist listeners. This is a fit behavior. It keeps us in our current social group and helps us avoid the emotional and social upheaval of changing beliefs or opinions. Thirdly, therefore, it seems to me that we do indeed live in a world where logical faculties are often more fit than accurate. Thus, Plantinga's argument is a bit unconvincing to me. It also puts me a bit at odds with Law. He was trying to debunk the second premise, and I was over here thinking, well, I think that premise is true. Moreover, I think that that describes this world I live in more accurately than some other world where our logical faculties are more adept. Lastly, I recognize there is a field of human reason that is not so prone to these issues, namely mathematics. For some reason, math seems free enough of the kinds of emotional intensity that lead smart humans astray. Generally, competent mathematicians are able to recognize a proof as true, even when their worst enemy wrote it. It also seems that the fields that are most close to maths are similarly protected, symbolic logic, for example. So maybe Plantinga's argument could say that in a materialistic Darwinian situation, we wouldn't expect this most basic kind of logical faculty. But then I'd start agreeing with Law that a clear understanding, if P then Q, arguably the first step for any maths or logic, is an incredible fitness advantage, allowing us to predict outcomes and thus better prepare and survive. Anyway, probably not a letter you'd expect from a Christian, but I felt like Plantinga was the one on more shaky logical ground here, trying not to play favourites. Keep on producing great content. Thank you very much, Nate. Yes, it was a deep one, deep dive, that one. And who knows, maybe we'll get a chance to revisit the subject again with Plantinga. Great to hear from you. Thank you very much for getting in touch. And let's finish off with just a couple more of your responses to the debate on veganism. Read out a number of responses last week to that, including quite a long letter from an old friend of mine, Antonia. Daniel wanted to get in touch to come back on that. He says, I found it really difficult to listen to that letter from your friend Antonia, where she discussed the veganism debate between Greg Boyd and Joshua D. Jones. She kept insisting, as a vegan, she has all the facts on her side. She feels dismayed that people cannot face those facts, but I've heard all those things before. I've heard the claims that veganism is a better way to treat animals, better for the environment, better for our health. I've heard smart and intelligent people say the exact opposite. I've heard people address all of the points she makes. As to carbon emissions, they would say she doesn't understand the carbon cycle. And she also seemed to forget that Joshua mentioned cattle farms that have achieved carbon sinks. To health, she's claimed that vegan diets are complete and healthy, citing a popular documentary. I've seen documentaries saying the opposite, and that attempts to supplement the deficiencies or costly failures, or sometimes even damaging in the case of the effects of soy products on people. I get her attitude. We see that a lot in public discourse. Justin, I'm sure that you've seen it more than most. People are convinced they're right, but they're frustrated that not everyone else sees it that way. Justin, I find some of your best shows to be when both guests are completely at odds, but they still treat each other with dignity and respect. I remember thinking Greg and Joshua's debate was another great example when I listened. As might be obvious from the rest of this email, I tend to agree with Joshua's points. I myself have recently gone back to a carnivore diet from previously eating a ketogenic diet that included plant foods. I'm a Christian. I hope Antonia wouldn't try to put me down for that. I have my reasons for going back to carnivore, including deeply personal family health reasons. Even if she disagrees with my reasons, I would hope Antonia would respect them as I would respect hers. Thank you very much, Daniel, for getting in touch. And just one final one from Leah in Minnesota. She says, Justin, I'm an avid listener of the show. Thank you for the amazing resource. I listen every day as I drive around. I'm a full-time grocery shopper and deliverer and literally talk back to the show as I'm driving. I've thought about replying multiple times, but not felt as compelled to respond as I was since listening to the vegan debate. As someone who has suffered with anorexia nervosa for a decade, coming to Christ 4 years into my illness, I'm very passionate about this topic. Secular diet culture and beauty standards have infiltrated the church, and the rise of vegetarianism and veganism is just one more way for Christians to cover up their obsession with thinness and weight loss in a holy way. It's extremely frustrating to hear talk among those who follow Christ to be preaching a gospel of weight loss, not the life-transforming gospel of Jesus Christ. As someone who battles an eating disorder every day, I wish that the church could be one safe place where I wouldn't have to be worried about being triggered and indoctrinated with diet rhetoric. But as the veganism surge shows, this is not the case. Thank you, Leah. Just one among a number of emails we received on that vegan debate. Thanks to all of those who've been in touch. Always good to hear your thoughts, whether positive or critical of the shows that we've aired here on Unbelievable. And do tell others about it too. And why not check out some of our other podcast offerings as well, if that's the way you listen to Unbelievable. You might enjoy the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath, or the Ask NT Write Anything show as well, all produced by Premier. Thanks for being with us. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. Continuing our autumn of cultural and ethical debates, we're asking, is the church too woke or just broke? Owen Strahan, author of Christianity and Wokeness, How the Social Justice Movement is Hijacking the Gospel and the Way to Stop It, is going to be coming on opposite the Reverend Jermaine Marshall, the author of Christianity Corrupted, The Scandal of White Supremacy. That should be an interesting one. Hope you can tune in same time next week. See you then.